Memorial Church at midnight to lie on our backs and listen to our voices echo in the apse. And so on. Then I learned that Virginia Woolf once boarded a battleship dressed as Abyssinian royalty and, duly chastened, stopped boasting about our trivial pranks. Senior year, in one of my last neuroscience classes, on neuroscience and ethics, we visited a home for people who had suffered severe brain injuries. We walked into the main reception area and were greeted by a disconsolate wailing. Our guide, a friendly 30-something woman, introduced herself to the group, but my eyes hunted for the source of the noise. Behind the reception counter was a large screen television showing a soap opera on mute. A blue-eyed brunette with well-coiffed hair, her head shaking slightly with emotion, filled the screen as she pleaded with someone off-camera. Zoom out, and there was her strong-jawed, undoubtedly gravel-voiced lover. They embraced passionately. The wailing rose in pitch. I stepped closer to peer over the counter, and there, on a blue mat in front of the television, in a plain flower-print dress, was a young woman, maybe 20, her hands balled into fists, pressed into her eyes, violently rocking back and forth, wailing and wailing. As she rocked, I caught glimpses of the back of her head, where her hair had worn away, leaving a large pale patch of skin. I stepped back to join the group, which was leaving to tour the facility. Talking with the guide, I learned that many of the residents had nearly drowned as young children. Looking around, I noticed there were no other visitors besides us. "Was that common?" I asked. "At first," the guide explained, "a family will visit constantly, daily, or even twice a day. Then maybe every other day. Then just weekends. After months or years, the visits taper off, until it's just, say, birthdays and Christmas. Eventually, most families move away, as far as they can get." "I don't blame them," she said. "It's hard caring for these kids." A fury churned in me. Hard? Of course it was hard. But how could parents abandon these kids? In one room, the patients lay on cots, mostly still, arranged in neat rows, like soldiers in a barracks. I walked down a row until I made eye contact with one of them. She was in her late teens, with dark, tangled hair. I paused and tried smiling at her, showing her I cared. I picked up one of her hands. It was limp. But she gurgled and, looking right at me, smiled. "I think she's smiling," I said to the attendant. "Could be," she said. "It can be hard to tell sometimes." But I was sure of it. She was smiling. When we got back to campus, I was the last one left in the room with the professor. "So, what'd you think?" he asked. I vented openly about how I couldn't believe that parents had abandoned these poor kids and how one of them had even smiled at me. The professor was a mentor, someone who thought deeply about how science and morality intersected. I expected him to agree with me. "Yeah," he said. "Good. Good for you. But sometimes, you know, I think it's better if they die." I grabbed my bag and left. She had been smiling. Hadn't she? Only later would I realize that our trip had added a new dimension to my understanding of the fact that brains give rise to our ability to form relationships and make life meaningful. Sometimes, they break. As graduation loomed, I had a nagging sense that there was still far too much unresolved for me, that I wasn't done studying. I applied for a master's in English literature at Stanford and was accepted into the program. I had come to see language as an almost supernatural force, existing between people, bringing our brains, shielded in centimeter-thick skulls, into communion. A word meant something only between people, and life's meaning, its virtue, had something to do with the depth of the relationships we formed. It was the relational aspect of humans, i.e. human relationality, that undergirded meaning. Yet somehow, this process existed in brains and bodies subject to their own physiologic imperatives, prone to breaking and failing. There must be a way, I thought, that the language of life as experienced, of passion, of hunger, of love, bore some relationship, however convoluted, to the language of neurons, digestive tracts, and heartbeats. At Stanford, I had the good fortune to study with Richard Rorty, perhaps the greatest living philosopher of his day, and under his tutelage, I began to see all disciplines as creating a vocabulary, a set of tools for understanding human life in a particular way. Great literary works provided their own sets of tools, compelling the reader to use that vocabulary. For my thesis, I studied the work of Walt Whitman, a poet who, a century before, was possessed by the same questions that haunted me, who wanted to find a way to understand and describe what he termed the physiological, spiritual man. As I finished my thesis, I could only conclude that Whitman had had no better luck than the rest of us at building a coherent physiological, spiritual vocabulary. But at least the ways in which he'd failed were illuminating. I was also increasingly certain that I had little desire to continue in literary studies, whose main preoccupations had begun to strike me as overly political and averse to science. One of my thesis advisors remarked that finding a community for myself in the literary world would be difficult, because most English PhDs reacted to science, as he put it, like apes to fire, with sheer terror. I wasn't sure where my life was headed. My thesis, Whitman and the Medicalization of Personality, was well received, but it was unorthodox, including as much history of psychiatry and neuroscience as literary criticism. It didn't quite fit in an English department. I didn't quite fit in an English department. Some of my closest friends from college were headed to New York City to pursue a life in the arts, some in comedy, others in journalism and television, and I briefly considered joining them and starting anew. But I couldn't quite let go of the question. Where did biology, morality, literature, and philosophy intersect? Walking home from a football game one afternoon, the autumn breeze blowing, I let my mind wander. Augustine's voice in the garden commanded, "Take up and read." But the voice I heard commanded the opposite. Set aside the books and practice medicine. Suddenly, it all seemed obvious. Although, or perhaps because, my father, my uncle, and my elder brother were all doctors, medicine had never occurred to me as a serious possibility. But hadn't Whitman himself written that only the physician could truly understand the physiological, spiritual man? The next day, I consulted a pre-med advisor to figure out the logistics. Getting ready for medical school would take about a year of intense coursework, plus the application time, which added up to another 18 months. It would mean letting my friends go to New York to continue deepening those relationships without me. It would mean setting aside literature. But it would allow me a chance to find answers that are not in books, to find a different sort of sublime, to forge relationships with the suffering, and to keep following the question of what makes human life meaningful, even in the face of death and decay. I began working through the necessary pre-medical courses, loading up on chemistry and physics. Reluctant to take a part-time job, it would slow my studies, but unable to afford Palo Alto rent, I found an open window in an empty dormitory and climbed in. After a few weeks of squatting, I was discovered by the caretaker, who happened to be a friend. She provided a key to the room and some useful warnings, like when the high school girls' cheerleading camps would be coming through. Thinking it wise to avoid becoming a registered sex offender, I'd pack a tent, some books and granola, and head up to Tahoe until it was safe to return. Because the med school application cycle takes 18 months, I had a free year once my classes were over. Several professors had suggested I pursue a degree in the history and philosophy of science and medicine before deciding to leave academia for good. So I applied for and was accepted into the HPS program at Cambridge. I spent the next year in classrooms in the English countryside, where I found myself increasingly often arguing that direct experience of life-and-death questions was essential to generating substantial moral opinions about them. Words began to feel as weightless as the breath that carried them. Stepping back, I realized that I was merely confirming what I already knew. I wanted that direct experience. It was only in practicing medicine that I could pursue a serious biological philosophy. Moral speculation was puny compared to moral action. I finished my degree and headed back to the States. I was going to Yale for medical school. You would think that the first time you cut up a dead person, you'd feel a bit funny about it. Strangely, though, everything feels normal. The bright lights, stainless steel tables, and bow-tied professors lend an air of propriety. Even so, that first cut, running from the nape of the neck down to the small of the back, is unforgettable. The scalpel is so sharp it doesn't so much cut the skin as unzip it, revealing the hidden and forbidden sinew beneath. And despite your preparation, you are caught unawares, ashamed, and excited. Cadaver dissection is a medical rite of passage and a trespass on the sacrosanct, engendering a legion of feelings from revulsion, exhilaration, nausea, frustration, and awe to, as time passes, the mere tedium of academic exercise. Everything teeters between pathos and bathos. Here you are, violating society's most fundamental taboos. And yet, formaldehyde is a powerful appetite stimulant, so you also crave a burrito. Eventually, as you complete your assignments by dissecting the median nerve, sawing the pelvis in half, and slicing open the heart, the bathos supersedes. The sacred violation takes on the character of your average college class, replete with pedants, class clowns, and the rest. Cadaver dissection epitomizes, for many, the transformation of the somber, respectful student into the callous, arrogant doctor. The enormity of the moral mission of medicine lent my early days of med school a severe gravity. The first day, before we got to the cadavers, was CPR training, my second time doing it. The first time, back in college, had been farcical, unserious, everyone laughing. The terribly acted videos and limbless plastic mannequins couldn't have been more artificial. But now, the lurking possibility that we would have to employ these skills someday animated everything. As I repeatedly slammed my palm into the chest of a tiny plastic child, I couldn't help but hear, along with my fellow students' jokes, real ribs cracking. Cadavers reverse the polarity. The mannequins you pretend are real. The cadavers you pretend are fake. But that first day, you just can't. When I faced my cadaver, slightly blue and bloated, his total deadness and total humanness were undeniable. The knowledge that in 4 months I would be bisecting this man's head with a hacksaw seemed unconscionable. Yet there are anatomy professors, and the advice they gave us was to take one good look at our cadaver's face and then leave it covered. It makes the work easier. Just as we prepared, with deep breaths and earnest looks, to unwrap our cadaver's head, a surgeon stopped by to chat, leaning with his elbows on the corpse's face. Pointing out various marks and scars on the naked torso, he reconstructed the patient's history. This scar is from an inguinal hernia operation. This one, a carotid endarterectomy. These marks here indicate scratching, possibly jaundice, high bilirubin. He probably died of pancreatic cancer, though no scar for that, killed him too quick. Meanwhile, I could not help but stare at the shifting elbows that, with each medical hypothesis and vocabulary lesson, rolled over this covered head. I thought, prosopagnosia is a neurological disorder wherein one loses the ability to see faces. Pretty soon, I would have it, hacksaw in hand. Because after a few weeks, the drama dissipated. In conversations with non-medical students, telling cadaver stories, I found myself highlighting the grotesque, macabre, and absurd, as if to reassure them that I was normal, even though I was spending 6 hours a week carving up a corpse. Sometimes I told of the moment when I turned around and saw a classmate, the sort of woman who had a mug decorated with puffy paint, tiptoeing on a stool, cheerfully hammering a chisel into a woman's backbone, splinters flying through the air. I told this story as if to distance myself from it. But my kinship was undeniable. After all, hadn't I just as eagerly disassembled a man's rib cage with a pair of bolt cutters? Even working on the dead, with their faces covered, their names a mystery, you find that their humanity pops up at you. In opening my cadaver stomach, I found 2 undigested morphine pills, meaning that he had died in pain, perhaps alone and fumbling with the cap of a pill bottle. Of course, the cadavers, in life, donated themselves freely to this fate, and the language surrounding the bodies in front of us soon changed to reflect that fact. We were instructed to no longer call them cadavers. Donors was the preferred term. And yes, the transgressive element of dissection had certainly decreased from the bad old days. Students no longer had to bring their own bodies, for starters, as they did in the 19th century. And medical schools had discontinued their support of the practice of robbing graves to procure cadavers. That looting itself a vast improvement over murder, a means once common enough to warrant its own verb, burk, which the OED defines as to kill secretly by suffocation or strangulation, or for the purpose of selling the victim's body for dissection. Yet the best informed people, doctors, almost never donated their bodies. How informed were the donors then? As one anatomy professor put it to me, you wouldn't tell a patient the gory details of a surgery if that would make them not consent. Even if donors were informed enough, and they might well have been, notwithstanding one anatomy professor's hedging, it wasn't so much the thought of being dissected that galled. It was the thought of your mother, your father, your grandparents being hacked to pieces by wisecracking 22-year-old medical students. Every time I read the pre-lab and saw a term like bone saw, I wondered if this would be the session in which I finally vomited. Yet I was rarely troubled in lab, even when I found that the bone saw in question was nothing more than a common rusty wood saw. The closest I ever came to vomiting was nowhere near the lab, but on a visit to my grandmother's grave in New York on the 20th anniversary of her death. I found myself doubled over, almost crying and apologizing, not to my cadaver, but to my cadaver's grandchildren. In the midst of our lab, in fact, a son requested his mother's half-dissected body back. Yes, she had consented, but he couldn't live with that. I knew I'd do the same. The remains were returned. In anatomy lab, we objectified the dead, literally reducing them to organs, tissues, nerves, muscles. On that first day, you simply could not deny the humanity of the corpse. But by the time you'd skinned the limbs, sliced through inconvenient muscles, pulled out the lungs, cut open the heart, and removed a lobe of the liver, it was hard to recognize this pile of tissue as human. Anatomy lab, in the end, becomes less a violation of the sacred and more something that interferes with happy hour. And that realization discomfits. In our rare reflective moments, we were all silently apologizing to our cadavers, not because we sensed the transgression, but because we did not. It was not a simple evil, however. All of medicine, not just cadaver dissection, trespasses into sacred spheres. Doctors invade the body in every way imaginable. They see people at their most vulnerable, their most scared, their most private. They escort them into the world and then back out. Seeing the body as matter and mechanism is the flip side to easing the most profound human suffering. By the same token, the most profound human suffering becomes a mere pedagogical tool. Anatomy professors are perhaps the extreme end of this relationship, yet their kinship to the cadavers remains. Early on, when I made a long, quick cut through my donor's diaphragm in order to ease finding the splenic artery, our proctor was both livid and horrified. Not because I had destroyed an important structure or misunderstood a key concept or ruined a future dissection, but because I had seemed so cavalier about it. The look on his face, his inability to vocalize his sadness, taught me more about medicine than any lecture I would ever attend. When I explained that another anatomy professor had told me to make the cut, our proctor's sadness turned to rage, and suddenly red-faced professors were being dragged into the hallway. Other times, the kinship was much simpler. Once, while showing us the ruins of our donor's pancreatic cancer, the professor asked, "How old is this fellow?" 74. We replied. "That's my age," he said, set down the probe, and walked away. Medical school sharpened my understanding of the relationship between meaning, life, and death. I saw the human relationality I had written about as an undergraduate realized in the doctor-patient relationship. As medical students, we were confronted by death, suffering, and the work entailed in patient care, while being simultaneously shielded from the real brunt of responsibility, though we could spot its specter. Med students spend the first 2 years in classrooms, socializing, studying, and reading. It was easy to treat the work as a mere extension of undergraduate studies. But my girlfriend, Lucy, whom I met in the first year of medical school, and who would later become my wife, understood the subtext of the academics. Her capacity to love was barely finite, and a lesson to me. One night on the sofa in my apartment, while studying the reams of wavy lines that make up EKGs, she puzzled over, then correctly identified, a fatal arrhythmia. All at once, it dawned on her, and she began to cry. Wherever this practice EKG had come from, the patient had not survived. The squiggly lines on that page were more than just lines. They were ventricular fibrillation deteriorating to a systole, and they could bring you to tears. Lucy and I attended the Yale School of Medicine when Shep Newland still lectured there, but I knew him only in my capacity as a reader. Newland was a renowned surgeon philosopher whose seminal book about mortality, How We Die, had come out when I was in high school, but made it into my hands only in medical school. Few books I had read so directly and wholly addressed that fundamental fact of existence. All organisms, whether goldfish or grandchild, die. I pored over it in my room at night, and remember in particular his description of his grandmother's illness, and how that one passage so perfectly illuminated the ways in which the personal, medical, and spiritual all intermingled. Newland recalled how, as a child, he would play a game in which, using his finger, he indented his grandmother's skin to see how long it took to resume its shape, a part of the aging process that, along with her newfound shortness of breath, showed her gradual slide into congestive heart failure, the significant decline in the amount of oxygen that aged blood is capable of taking up from the aged tissues of the aged lung. But what was most evident, he continued, was the slow drawing away from life. By the time Bubby stopped praying, she had stopped virtually everything else as well. With her fatal stroke, Newland remembered Sir Thomas Browne's Religio Medici. With what strife and pains we come into the world, we know not, but 'tis commonly no easy matter to get out of it. I had spent so much time studying literature at Stanford and the history of medicine at Cambridge in an attempt to better understand the particularities of death, only to come away feeling like they were still unknowable to me. Descriptions like Newland's convinced me that such things could be known only face to face. I was pursuing medicine to bear witness to the twinned mysteries of death, its experiential and biological manifestations, at once deeply personal and utterly impersonal. I remember Newland, in the opening chapters of How We Die, writing about being a young medical student alone in the OR with a patient whose heart had stopped. In an act of desperation, he cut open the patient's chest and tried to pump his heart manually, tried to literally squeeze the life back into him. The patient died, and Newland was found by a supervisor covered in blood and failure. Medical school had changed by the time I got there, to the point where such a scene was simply unthinkable. As medical students, we were barely allowed to touch patients, let alone open their chests. What had not changed, though, was the heroic spirit of responsibility amid blood and failure. This struck me as the true image of a doctor. The first birth I witnessed was also the first death. I had recently taken step one of my medical boards, wrapping up 2 years of intensive study buried in books, deep in libraries, poring over lecture notes in coffee shops, reviewing handmade flashcards while lying in bed. The next 2 years, then, I would spend in the hospital and clinic, finally putting that theoretical knowledge to use to relieve concrete suffering, with patients, not abstractions, as my primary focus. I started in OBGYN, working the graveyard shift in the labor and delivery ward. Walking into the building as the sun descended, I tried to recall the stages of labor, the corresponding dilation of the cervix, the names of the stations that indicated the baby's descent, anything that might prove helpful when the time came. As a medical student, my task was to learn by observation and avoid getting in the way. Residents who had finished medical school and were now completing training in a chosen specialty, and nurses with their years of clinical experience, would serve as my primary instructors. But the fear still lurked. I could feel its fluttering, that through accident or expectation, I'd be called on to deliver a child by myself and fail. I made my way to the doctor's lounge where I was to meet the resident. I walked in and saw a dark-haired young woman lying on a couch, chomping furiously at a sandwich while watching TV and reading a journal article. I introduced myself. "Oh, hi," she said. "I'm Melissa. I'll be in here or in the call room if you need me. Probably the best thing for you to do is keep an eye on patient Garcia. She's a 22-year-old here with preterm labor and twins. Everyone else is pretty standard." Between bites, Melissa briefed me, a barrage of facts and information. The twins were only 23.5 weeks old. The hope was to keep the pregnancy going until they were more developed, however long that might be. 24 weeks was considered the cusp of viability, and every extra day made a difference. The patient was getting various drugs to control her contractions. Melissa's pager went off. "Okay," she said, swinging her legs off the couch. "I gotta go. You can hang out here if you like. We have good cable channels. Or you can come with me." I followed Melissa to the nurse's station. One wall was lined with monitors, displaying wavy telemetry lines. "What's that?" I asked. "That's the output of the tachometers and the fetal heart rates. Let me show you the patient. She doesn't speak English. Do you speak Spanish?" I shook my head. Melissa brought me to the room. It was dark. The mother lay in a bed, resting, quiet, monitor bands wrapped around her belly, tracking her contractions and the twins' heart rates, and sending the signal to the screens I'd seen at the nurse's station. The father stood at the bedside holding his wife's hand, worry etched on his brow. Melissa whispered something to them in Spanish, then escorted me out. For the next several hours, things progressed smoothly. Melissa slept in the lounge. I tried decoding the indecipherable scribbles in Garcia's chart, which was like reading hieroglyphics, and came away with the knowledge that her first name was Elena. This was her second pregnancy. She had received no prenatal care, and she had no insurance. I wrote down the names of the drugs she was getting and made a note to look them up later. I read a little about premature labor in a textbook I found in the doctor's lounge. Preemies, if they survived, apparently incurred high rates of brain hemorrhages and cerebral palsy. Then again, my older brother Suman had been born almost 8 weeks premature, 3 decades earlier, and he was now a practicing neurologist. I walked over to the nurse and asked her to teach me how to read those little squiggles on the monitor, which were no clearer to me than the doctor's handwriting, but could apparently foretell calm or disaster. She nodded and began talking me through reading a contraction and the fetal heart's reaction to it, the way if you looked closely you could see. She stopped. Worry flashed across her face. Without a word, she got up and ran into Elena's room, then burst back out, grabbed the phone, and paged Melissa. A minute later, Melissa arrived, bleary-eyed, glanced at the strips, and rushed into the patient's room, with me trailing behind. She flipped open her cell phone and called the attending, rapidly talking in a jargon I only partially understood. The twins were in distress, I gathered, and their only shot at survival was an emergency C-section. I was carried along with the commotion into the operating room. They got Elena supine on the table, drugs running into her veins. A nurse frantically painted the woman's swollen abdomen with an antiseptic solution, while the attending, the resident, and I splashed alcohol cleanser on our hands and forearms. I mimicked their urgent strokes, standing silently as they cursed under their breath. The anesthesiologists intubated the patient, while the senior surgeon, the attending, fidgeted. "Come on," he said. "We don't have a lot of time. We need to move faster." I was standing next to the attending as he sliced open the woman's belly, making a single long curvilinear incision beneath her belly button, just below the apex of her protuberant womb. I tried to follow every movement, digging in my brain for textbook anatomical sketches. The skin slid apart at the scalpel's touch. He sliced confidently through the tough white rectus fascia covering the muscle, then split the fascia and the underlying muscle with his hands, revealing the first glimpse of the melon-like uterus. He sliced that open as well, and a small face appeared, then disappeared amid the blood. In plunged the doctor's hands, pulling out one, then two purple babies, barely moving, eyes fused shut, like tiny birds fallen too soon from a nest. With their bones visible through translucent skin, they looked more like the preparatory sketches of children than children themselves. Too small to cradle, not much bigger than the surgeon's hands, they were rapidly passed to the waiting neonatal intensivists, who rushed them to the neonatal ICU. With the immediate danger averted, the pace of the operation slowed, frenzy turning to something resembling calm. The odor of burnt flesh wafted up as the cautery arrested little spurts of blood. The uterus was sutured back together, the stitches like a row of teeth, biting closed the open wound. "Professor, do you want the peritoneum closed?" Melissa asked. "I read recently that it doesn't need to be." "Let no man put asunder what God has joined," the attending said. "At least no more than temporarily. I like to leave things the way I found them. Let's sew it back up." The peritoneum is a membrane that surrounds the abdominal cavity. Somehow I had completely missed its opening, and I couldn't see it at all now. To me, the wound looked like a mass of disorganized tissue, yet to the surgeons it had an appreciable order, like a block of marble to a sculptor. Melissa called for the peritoneal stitch, reached her forceps into the wound, and pulled up a transparent layer of tissue between the muscle and the uterus. Suddenly, the peritoneum and the gaping hole in it was clear. She sewed it closed and moved on to the muscle and fascia, putting them back together with a large needle and a few big looping stitches. The attending left, and finally the skin was sutured together. Melissa asked me if I wanted to place the last two stitches. My hand shook as I passed the needle through the subcutaneous tissue. As I tightened down the suture, I saw that the needle was slightly bent. The skin had come together lopsided, a glob of fat poking through. Melissa sighed. "That's uneven," she said. "You have to just catch the dermal layer. You see this thin white stripe?" I did. Not only would my mind have to be trained, my eyes would too. "Scissors!" Melissa cut out my amateur knots, resutured the wound, applied the dressing, and the patient was taken to recovery. As Melissa had told me earlier, 24 weeks in utero was considered the edge of viability. The twins had lasted 23 weeks and 6 days. Their organs were present, but perhaps not yet ready for the responsibility of sustaining life. They were owed nearly 4 more months of protected development in the womb, where oxygenated blood and nutrients came to them through the umbilical cord. Now, oxygen would have to come through the lungs, and the lungs were not capable of the complex expansion and gas transfer that was respiration. I went to see them in the NICU, each twin encased in a clear plastic incubator, dwarfed by large beeping machines, barely visible amid the tangle of wires and tubes. The incubator had small side ports through which the parents could strain to reach and gently stroke a leg or arm, providing vital human contact. The sun was up, my shift over. I was sent home, the image of the twins being extracted from the uterus interrupting my sleep. Like a premature lung, I felt unready for the responsibility of sustaining life. When I returned to work that night, I was assigned to a new mother. No one anticipated problems with this pregnancy. Things were as routine as possible. Today was even her actual due date. Along with the nurse, I followed the mother's steady progress, contractions racking her body with increasing regularity. The nurse reported the dilation of the cervix, from 3 centimeters to 5 to 10. "Okay, it's time to push now," the nurse said. Turning to me, she said, "Don't worry, we'll page you when the delivery is close." I found Melissa in the doctor's lounge. After some time, the OB team was called into the room. Delivery was near. Outside the door, Melissa handed me a gown, gloves, and a pair of long boot covers. "It gets messy," she said. We entered the room. I stood awkwardly off to the side until Melissa pushed me to the front, between the patient's legs, just in front of the attending. "Push," the nurse encouraged. "Now again, just like that, only without the screaming." The screaming didn't stop, and was soon accompanied by a gush of blood and other fluids. The neatness of medical diagrams did nothing to represent nature. Red not only in tooth and claw, but in birth as well. An Anne Geddes photo, this was not. It was becoming clear that learning to be a doctor in practice was going to be a very different education from being a medical student in the classroom. Reading books and answering multiple-choice questions bore little resemblance to taking action, with its concomitant responsibility. Knowing you need to be judicious when pulling on the head to facilitate delivery of the shoulder is not the same as doing it. What if I pull too hard? Irreversible nerve injury, my brain shouted. The head appeared with each push, and then retracted with each break. 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. I waited. The human brain has rendered the organism's most basic task, reproduction, a treacherous affair. That same brain made things like labor and delivery units, cardiotachometers, epidurals, and emergency C-sections both possible and necessary. I stood still, unsure when to act or what to do. The attending's voice guided my hands to the emerging head, and on the next push, I gently guided the baby's shoulders as she came out. She was large, plump, and wet, easily 3 times the size of the bird-like creatures from the previous night. Melissa clamped the cord, and I cut it. The child's eyes opened, and she began to cry. I held the baby a moment longer, feeling her weight and substance, then passed her to the nurse, who brought her to the mother. I walked out to the waiting room to inform the extended family of the happy news. The 12 or so family members gathered there leapt up to celebrate, a riot of handshakes and hugs. I was a prophet returning from the mountaintop with news of a joyous new covenant. All the messiness of the birth disappeared. Here I had just been holding the newest member of this family, this man's niece, this girl's cousin. Returning to the ward, ebullient, I ran into Melissa. "Hey, do you know how last night's twins are doing?" I asked. She darkened. Baby A died yesterday afternoon. Baby B managed to live not quite 24 hours, then passed away around the time I was delivering the new baby. In that moment, I could only think of Samuel Beckett, the metaphors that, in those twins, reached their terminal limit. One day we were born, one day we shall die, the same day, the same second. Birth astride of a grave. The light gleams an instant. Then it's night once more. I had stood next to the gravedigger with his forceps. What had these lives amounted to? "You think that's bad?" she continued. "Most mothers with stillborns still have to go through labor and deliver. Can you imagine? At least these guys had a chance." A match flickers, but does not light. The mother's wailing in room 543, the searing red rims of the father's lower eyelids, tears silently streaking his face. This flip side of joy, the unbearable, unjust, unexpected presence of death. What possible sense could be made? What words were there for comfort? "Was it the right choice, to do an emergency C-section?" I asked. "No question," she said. "It was the only shot they had." "What happens if you don't?" "Probably they die. Abnormal fetal heart tracings show when the fetal blood is turning acidemic, the cord is compromised somehow, or something else seriously bad is happening." "But how do you know when the tracing looks bad enough? Which is worse, being born too early or waiting too long to deliver?" "Judgment call." What a call to make. In my life, had I ever made a decision harder than choosing between a French dip and a Reuben? How could I ever learn to make and live with such judgment calls? I still had a lot of practical medicine to learn, But would knowledge alone be enough, with life and death hanging in the balance? Surely intelligence wasn't enough. Moral clarity was needed as well. Somehow, I had to believe I would gain not only knowledge, but wisdom, too. After all, when I had walked into the hospital just one day before, birth and death had been merely abstract concepts. Now I had seen them both up close. Maybe Beckett's Pazzo is right. Maybe life is merely an instant, too brief to consider. But my focus would have to be on my imminent role, intimately involved with the when and how of death, the gravedigger with the forceps. Not long after, my OBGYN rotation ended, and it was immediately on to surgical oncology. Mari, a fellow med student, and I would rotate together. A few weeks in, after a sleepless night, she was assigned to assist in a Whipple, a complex operation that involves rearranging most abdominal organs in an attempt to resect pancreatic cancer, an operation in which a medical student typically stands still, or at best retracts, for up to 9 hours straight. It's considered the plum operation to be selected to help with, because of its extreme complexity. Only chief residents are allowed to actively participate. But it is grueling, the ultimate test of a general surgeon's skill. 15 minutes after the operation started, I saw Mari in the hallway, crying. The surgeon always begins a Whipple by inserting a small camera through a tiny incision to look for metastases, as widespread cancer renders the operation useless and causes its cancellation. Standing there, waiting in the OR with a 9-hour surgery stretching out before her, Mari had a whisper of a thought. "I'm so tired. Please, God, let there be Mets." There were. The patient was sewn back up, the procedure called off. First came relief, then a gnawing, deepening shame. Mari burst out of the OR, where, needing a confessor, she saw me, and I became one. In the fourth year of medical school, I watched as, one by one, many of my classmates elected to specialize in less demanding areas. Radiology or dermatology, for example, and applied for their residencies. Puzzled by this, I gathered data from several elite medical schools and saw that the trends were the same. By the end of medical school, most students tended to focus on lifestyle specialties, those with more humane hours, higher salaries, and lower pressures, the idealism of their med school application essays tempered or lost. As graduation neared and we sat down, in a Yale tradition, to rewrite our commencement oath, a melding of the words of Hippocrates, Maimonides, Osler, along with a few other great medical forefathers, several students argued for the removal of language insisting that we place our patients' interests above our own. The rest of us didn't allow this discussion to continue for long. The word stayed. This kind of egotism struck me as antithetical to medicine and, it should be noted, entirely reasonable. Indeed, this is how 99% of people select their jobs: pay, work environment, hours. But that's the point. Putting lifestyle first is how you find a job, not a calling. As for me, I would choose neurosurgery as my specialty. The choice, which I had been contemplating for some time, was cemented one night in a room just off the OR, when I listened in quiet awe as a pediatric neurosurgeon sat down with the parents of a child with a large brain tumor who had come in that night complaining of headaches. He not only delivered the clinical facts, but addressed the human facts as well, acknowledging the tragedy of the situation and providing guidance. As it happened, the child's mother was a radiologist. The tumor looked malignant. The mother had already studied the scans, and now she sat in a plastic chair under fluorescent light, devastated. "Now, Claire," the surgeon began softly. "Is it as bad as it looks?" the mother interrupted. "Do you think it's cancer?" I don't know. What I do know, and I know you know these things too, is that your life is about to... It already has changed. This is going to be a long haul, you understand? You have got to be there for each other, but you also have to get your rest when you need it. This kind of illness can either bring you together or it can tear you apart. Now more than ever, you have to be there for each other. I don't want either of you staying up all night at the bedside or never leaving the hospital, okay? He went on to describe the planned operation, the likely outcomes and possibilities, what decisions needed to be made now, what decisions they should start thinking about but didn't need to decide on immediately, and what sorts of decisions they should not worry about at all yet. By the end of the conversation, the family was not at ease, but they seemed able to face the future. I had watched the parents' faces, at first wan, dull, almost otherworldly, sharpen and focus. And as I sat there, I realized that the questions intersecting life, death, and meaning, questions that all people face at some point, usually arise in a medical context. In the actual situations where one encounters these questions, it becomes a necessarily philosophical and biological exercise. Humans are organisms, subject to physical laws, including, alas, the one that says entropy always increases. Diseases are molecules misbehaving. The basic requirement of life is metabolism, and death, its cessation. While all doctors treat diseases, neurosurgeons work in the crucible of identity. Every operation on the brain is, by necessity, a manipulation of the substance of ourselves. And every conversation with the patient undergoing brain surgery cannot help but confront this fact. In addition to the patient and family, the brain surgery is usually the most dramatic event they have ever faced and, as such, has the impact of any major life event. At those critical junctures, the question is not simply whether to live or die, but what kind of life is worth living. Would you trade your ability, or your mother's, to talk for a few extra months of mute life? The expansion of your visual blind spot in exchange for eliminating the small possibility of a fatal brain hemorrhage? Your right hand's function to stop seizures? How much neurologic suffering would you let your child endure before saying that death is preferable? Because the brain mediates our experience of the world, any neurosurgical problem forces a patient and family, ideally with a doctor as a guide, to answer this question. What makes life meaningful enough to go on living? I was compelled by neurosurgery, with its unforgiving call to perfection. Like the ancient Greek concept arete, I thought virtue required moral, emotional, mental, and physical excellence. Neurosurgery seemed to present the most challenging and direct confrontation with meaning, identity, and death. Concomitant with the enormous responsibilities they shouldered, neurosurgeons were also masters of many fields: neurosurgery, ICU medicine, neurology, radiology. Not only would I have to train my mind and hands, I realized, I'd have to train my eyes and perhaps other organs as well. The idea was overwhelming and intoxicating. Perhaps I, too, could join the ranks of these polymaths who strode into the densest thicket of emotional, scientific, and spiritual problems and found, or carved, ways out. After medical school, Lucy and I, newly married, headed to California to begin our residencies. Me at Stanford, Lucy just up the road at UCSF. Medical school was officially behind us. Now, real responsibility lay in wait. In short order, I made several close friends in the hospital. In particular, Victoria, my co-resident, and Jeff, a general surgery resident a few years senior to us. Over the next 7 years of training, we would grow from bearing witness to medical dramas to becoming leading actors in them. As an intern in the first year of residency, one is little more than a paper pusher against a backdrop of life and death, though even then the workload is enormous. My first day in the hospital, the chief resident said to me, "Neurosurgery residents aren't just the best surgeons. We're the best doctors in the hospital. That's your goal. Make us proud." The chairman, passing through the ward, "Always eat with your left hand. You've got to learn to be ambidextrous." One of the senior residents, "Just a heads up, the chief is going through a divorce, so he's really throwing himself into his work right now. Don't make small talk with him." The outgoing intern, who was supposed to orient me, but instead just handed me a list of 43 patients, "The only thing I have to tell you is, they can always hurt you more, but they can't stop the clock." And then he walked away. I didn't leave the hospital for the first 2 days, but before long, the impossible-seeming, day-killing mounds of paperwork were only an hour's work. Still, when you work in a hospital, the papers you file aren't just papers. They are fragments of narratives filled with risks and triumphs. An 8-year-old named Matthew, for example, came in one day complaining of headaches, only to learn that he had a tumor abutting his hypothalamus. The hypothalamus regulates our basic drives: sleep, hunger, thirst, sex. Leaving any tumor behind would subject Matthew to a life of radiation, further surgeries, brain catheters. In short, it would consume his childhood. Complete removal could prevent that, but at the risk of damaging his hypothalamus, rendering him a slave to his appetites. The surgeon got to work, passed a small endoscope through Matthew's nose, and drilled off the floor of his skull. Once inside, he saw a clear plane and removed the tumor. A few days later, Matthew was bopping around the ward, sneaking candies from the nurses, ready to go home. That night, I happily filled out the endless pages of his discharge paperwork. I lost my first patient on a Tuesday. She was an 82-year-old woman, small and trim, the healthiest person on the general surgery service, where I spent a month as an intern. At her autopsy, the pathologist would be shocked to learn her age. She has the organs of a 50-year-old. She had been admitted for constipation from a mild bowel obstruction. After 6 days of hoping her bowels would untangle themselves, we did a minor operation to help sort things out. Around 8 p.m. Monday night, I stopped by to check on her, and she was alert, doing fine. As we talked, I pulled from my pocket my list of the day's work and crossed off the last item: post-op check, Mrs. Harvey. It was time to go home and get some rest. Sometime after midnight, the phone rang. The patient was crashing. With the complacency of bureaucratic work suddenly torn away, I sat up in bed and spat out orders. 1 liter bolus of LR, EKG, chest X-ray, stat, I'm on my way in. I called my chief, and she told me to add labs and to call her back when I had a better sense of things. I sped to the hospital and found Mrs. Harvey struggling for air, her heart racing, her blood pressure collapsing. She wasn't getting better no matter what I did. And as I was the only general surgery intern on call, my pager was buzzing relentlessly with calls I could dispense with, patients needing sleep medication, and ones I couldn't, a rupturing aortic aneurysm in the ER. I was drowning, out of my depth, pulled in 1,000 directions, and Mrs. Harvey was still not improving. I arranged a transfer to the ICU, where we blasted her with drugs and fluids to keep her from dying, and I spent the next few hours running between my patient threatening to die in the ER and my patient actively dying in the ICU. By 5:45 a.m., the patient in the ER was on his way to the OR, and Mrs. Harvey was relatively stable. She'd needed 12 liters of fluid, 2 units of blood, a ventilator, and 3 different pressors to stay alive. When I finally left the hospital at 5 p.m. on Tuesday evening, Mrs. Harvey wasn't getting better. Or worse. At 7 p.m.,